This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're going to listen back to an interview with Mario Puzo. He died of heart failure 1 week ago at the age of 78. Puzo wrote the novel The Godfather and co-wrote all three Godfather screenplays.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice. How much shall I pay you?
Buonasera. Buonasera. What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they will fear you.
Be my friend. Godfather.
Good. Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Puzo and Francis Ford Coppola won Academy Awards for their Godfather screenplay. Puzo's novel, The Godfather, sold about 21 million copies. I spoke with Mario Puzo in 1996, after the publication of his novel, The Last Don, about a mafia family that tries to go legit and branches out into Vegas casinos and Hollywood studios. Puzo wrote so convincingly about the mafia, people always assumed he had some inside connection, which he denied. I asked him how the mafia became the theme of so much of his work.
It started off my second novel, The Fortunate Pilgrim, where a minor character was a mafia leader. And everybody said, gee, you should have had more of that character. And really, all it is telling stories I heard in my childhood, you know, about people in the neighborhood and all that stuff.
What neighborhood was it?
Hell's Kitchen in New York.
Isn't that primarily an Irish neighborhood?
It was, then it became Italian. So when I was growing up, it was primarily Italian with a good mixture of Irish and who started off as enemies and then intermarried a great deal.
So who'd you hear the stories from?
Oh, members of my family, you know, like the rug-stealing scene and the keeping of the guns from the police, you know, that kind of stuff that happened in the family.
Oh, well, tell the story the way it was told to you.
Well, my brother, who's older than me, this guy threw his guns over the airway, you know, the space between apartments, and my mother took them and held them for him. And then he came and got back his guns, and he said, would you like a rug? So she sent my brother over to get the rug. And my brother didn't realize the guy was stealing the rug until he took out the gun when the cop came. So that's almost entirely in the book and in the movie, you know. And there's little stuff like that.
Now, how did your mother feel about protecting this guy's guns?
Oh, in those days, this is when I was a very little kid, that was thought of as nothing. You know, that was like he was a neighbor and he wanted you to do it. And you did it because you were afraid of him, because you hoped, you know, that he would help you out.
Do you think your mother looked at the mob figures in your neighborhood as people who could protect your family or as people who were more likely to harm your family?
No, protect. Because, for instance, the business about the dog being permitted to stay in the apartment, that happened to my family. My mother didn't want to get rid of the dog, so she went to the local guy of respect. I don't even think they thought of them as criminals. There were people who had influence, the way you would go down to your congressman, for instance.
So tell the dog story.
No, as it happened in the movie, the landlord wanted my mother to get rid of the dog, and she didn't want to get rid of the dog. He was going to kick her out, and the local whatever he was. I never really understood what he was. He told the landlord not to do it, and the landlord didn't do it.
Did she owe anything in return?
No, it was she was the cousin or the niece of somebody who knew the mafia guy. You know, one of those very family things, you know, a family courtesy.
Did she do anything to pay respect to the local organized crime figures who in part controlled the neighborhood?
Well, you have to remember that those figures are usually related by blood, you know, and were members of a family, so you gave them presents. If you had a family member who was powerful, you made sure that you gave him a present at Christmas, you know, or a special occasion, which was not regarded as a payoff in any way. It was, for instance, my parents grew up in Italy, where since they were mostly illiterate, when they had a letter that had to be read, they would go to the local priest to have the priest read it for them, but they would automatically bring a gift. They'd bring three or four eggs or, you know, a chicken or something like that. It's a whole different relationship. It wasn't a bribe. It's a mark of respect. It's not like they said, you got to give me a piece of chicken or you got to give me an egg and I'll read it for you. It was just understood in the same way the local neighborhood guys that had influence, you gave them presents.
Describe Don Corleone the way you first envisioned him.
He was sort of very much like you had a brother who was much older than you, who would always protect you, you know, who would always stick up for you. He was somebody who was a protector.
I'm wondering if the character of Don Corleone was changed in your mind when Marlon Brando was cast in the film and you saw Marlon Brando inhabit the character.
No, I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando.
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Coppola, and he managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me, they're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much, and Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play the Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Why were they so opposed to the idea?
Well, because Brando had built up what to them was a terrible reputation of being a troublemaker, you know, and his Mutiny on a Bounty, we cost them a lot of money, and you know, he was always a rebel. So they didn't want him in their movies. He was too much of a headache, and his movies had been flops.
Did he cause any trouble for you on the set?
No, well, I was never on the set, but they tell me it was perfect. You know, every actor just loved the idea of working with Brando. He's their idol, so. And when he came on the picture, he caused no trouble for the director, he caused no trouble for the actors. He was, they really liked him.
What were some of the battles that you and Francis Ford Coppola had to fight with the studio?
Well, over Al Pacino. At first I was for Al Pacino, then when he tested so terribly, I was against him. And then Francis talked me around into being for him again, you know. Because I had given Francis a letter saying I wanted Pacino, and after I saw him test, I told Francis, give me my letter back. And he says, no, wait, you wouldn't give me the letter back.
What was so bad about the test?
Francis knew what was wrong with him. He said he was very insecure, and it was sort of like his way of saying, you know, the hell with you guys. I don't have to test for you guys, I think. Because Pacino, who I got to know a little bit, is really like the most dedicated actor, the most dedicated work person that I've ever met in the movies.
Now, what were some of the most difficult parts of adapting the novel into the screenplay?
You mean the first one?
Yeah, the novel one? Of The Godfather.
It was a cinch.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was a cinch because it was the first time I'd ever written a screenplay, so I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and it came out right. And the story I tell is that after I had won 2 Academy Awards, you know, for the first 2 Godfathers, I went out and bought a book on screenwriting because I figured I'd better learn, you know, what it's about, because it was sort of off the top of my head. And then the first chapter of the book said, study Godfather 1 as the model of a screenplay. So I was stuck with the book.
Now, I'm wondering, with the dialogue, everything is so, I mean, not everything, but the characters who really have power are very euphemistic in their language. So they could be giving you the message that they're going to kill you unless you follow their orders, but they'll be saying it in the nicest way. And of course, killing would never be mentioned. Everything's kind of beneath, you know, between the lines, beneath the surface. What made you write the dialogue for these powerful, violent people in that coded way?
Well, it does come from the way the Sicilian mafia operated. In fact, there was a funny story that an Englishman came to live in Sicily, and he got a kidnapping note, because they like to collect the money for kidnapping you before they kidnap you, so they didn't have to go to the bother of kidnapping you. That was the way they operated. But the Sicilian mafia wrote this Englishman such a flowery note that he really didn't understand what they were saying. He had to get an interpreter in. He thought they were paying him some sort of compliment. He didn't realize they wanted like 50 grand off him before they kidnapped him, so to save everybody the trouble of going through the kidnapping. But it was very flowery. Your Eminence, we love you, you know, we'll do anything. If you have any trouble, give us a call, you know. And meanwhile, just send us 50 grand and you'll never have any trouble with anybody. But that's how they talk. That's where I got it from. You know, that. And that horse's head thing was strictly from Sicilian folklore. They nailed the head of your favorite dog to your door as the first warning if you didn't pay the money. They were great believers in collecting money before doing the job.
One of the most famous lines that you came up with was about making an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
Does that line have its roots in mob lore that you knew, or did
I made it up. I wrote memos on how we could plant that line because I was sure it would become a famous line. You know, I recognized the fact it would become one of those lines that people would always be using. So that was really sort of carefully constructed, you know.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract with a big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson, and my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
How did he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story.
We'll continue our 1996 interview with Mario Puzo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Mario Puzo, the author of the novel The Godfather, co-author of the 3 Godfather screenplays. Puzo died 1 week ago of heart failure at the age of 78. Did you come up with the expression Godfather?
Yeah. And that was really an accident. Because before I used that, no mafia man ever used the word godfather in that sense. Nobody used it. And I got it from an Italian family culture. The friend of your parents when you're a little kid, your parents have very close friends, you call them godfather and godmother the way in the American culture you call family friends aunt and uncle, even though they're not your aunt and uncle. You know, if they're a close family friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're a kid, you say that's auntie or uncle so-and-so. So that was just the only way in which it was used, except this, in a religious sense. So I remembered it, and the more I used it during the book, the more it became, you know, what it was.
Do you think
so?
So
now the mafia uses it, everybody uses it, you know, and the word didn't exist.
Now, how did you become a reader and a writer? You've said that your parents were nearly illiterate.
They were illiterate, yeah. And because of the public libraries and the Settlement House Library, Hudson Gill Settlement House Library, and you started to read, and it was just the greatest thing in the world to read, that's all.
What did your parents think of you reading? It was something that they couldn't do. Were they proud of you for being able to do it?
No. I wrote a line someplace where my mother regarded my library card with the same horror that present-day mothers look at their son's heroin needles. You know, I made some sort of comparison to that. Reading was not relevant. Reading didn't help you make a living, you know?
Wrong.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So what did they think you should be doing? What did your mother think you should be doing instead?
Oh, you know, good clerical job on the inside. If you could avoid hard labor, that was the big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what your mother was thinking, that you couldn't make money as a writer, I think that was true of your first couple of books.
It was very true, yeah.
Did you figure that would always be the case, that you were never really going to make money writing?
I always thought I would become rich and famous and be a great writer. I always believed that until, let's see, when I stopped believing that. I stopped believing that after I wrote The Godfather. I'm only kidding. I think you get less confident as you become more successful. Before I was successful, I was very arrogant as a writer. You know, I wouldn't listen to anybody.
And after you became successful, you lost faith?
I was very shaky.
What could you explain that phenomenon?
Oh, I think it's easy to be arrogant when you're unsuccessful because you have nothing to lose. And, you know, I know I used to brag a lot more when I was unsuccessful than I do now. I do my share of bragging now, but before I was successful, I was really terrible.
How have you reacted to criticisms from Italians, for instance, that in American popular culture, Italians are always shown as mob figures, and criticisms from people who say that the Godfather movies were just really violent and, you know, up the amount of violence in American popular culture?
Yeah, well, it sounds like some of my relatives, but but to me, it's a completely irrelevant thing. For one thing, there was a time when Italians ran crime in America, so I'm not maligning them in any way. In fact, I present them as very lovable people, you know, that have to make a living, unfortunately, in a way that society doesn't approve. But also, I know that most Italians that I grew up with were so law-abiding, they, you know, that getting a traffic ticket was terrible, you know? You know, for the working-class Italian people.
Your novel and the Godfather movies have had such an impact on American popular culture. And I'm wondering what you think it is about the stories that enabled them to have the impact that they had.
Well, I think it's a story with warm personal family feeling. And I think also it's everybody's wish, I mean, that they would have somebody they could go to who would correct all their injustices without the problems of going to court, hiring a lawyer, you know, somebody fixing up your world for you.
And if you crossed them, you'd be dead.
But that's okay, because why would you want to cross them if they, you know, did everything for you?
Of course, it's, everybody does end up everybody, and there's always a bloodbath.
So, people are not perfect.
Yeah. Mario Puzo, recorded in 1996. He died of heart failure 1 week ago at the age of 78. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.